will help.
Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. We will continue listening to Tangent's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome once more to our weekly program. What do you think goes through most people's minds as they walk down Auckland's Queen Street in the middle of a typical busy day? I know that I feel slightly uncomfortable in such a situation. There are too many people. I feel slightly crowded out and have to watch where I'm stepping so I don't bump into anyone else. You feel as though you are one individual entity isolated from all the other isolated entities flowing up and down the street, don't you? Anyway, I do. And that is indicative of what is really wrong with us. When we see ourselves and others as little isolated islands floating along in the tides of history, it just means we've not seen the bigger picture, or joined the dots, as it were. We've failed to understand the dependent nature of all phenomena, how nothing, in fact, is an isolate, but depends on so many other things. If we look deeply enough, we will see that we are dependent on everything else in the universe. For instance, take the shirt you're wearing. If we trace back its history, we can see that before it arrived in the shop where you bought it, it was transported from the factory where it was made. And before it became a shirt in the factory, it was a collection of material and sewing apparatuses. Before material, there was cotton or some synthetic that had to be manufactured from other commodities. And so we can keep on going back and back almost endlessly. And what does that tell us? It's not only just a shirt on your back. It's a long and drawn-out collection of materials and occurrences that stretch back in time and which have touched the lives of all people in one way or another through history. And similarly, with those people walking down Queen Street, if we trace their histories back, how many will we find in some way touched our own history? Look deeply enough, and we will see them all, every one, as part of ourselves, our history, and our makeup. Perhaps that man hastening down the street who brushes your shoulder in his hurry was the very one who operated the machine that sewed your shirt together or cooked the meal you had for lunch at a restaurant. We are not isolates, and if we look even further back into our past lives, we will find even more connections stretching down through time to our present experiences. If we could trace the history of that man who brushed my shoulder way beyond our present lives to our previous lives, we will find inevitably that we were mother and child in a distant time. And that connection could well be part of the reason he brushed my shoulder. Our experiences are not little bubbles that blip up and then fade away serendipitously without causes and conditions. They occur quite precisely according to whatever has gone before them. Thich Nhat Hanh has a word for our dependence. He calls it interbeing. He takes as his example a sheet of paper. If you're a poet, he says, you will see clearly that there's a cloud floating in this sheet of paper. Without a cloud, there will be no rain. Without rain, the trees cannot grow. And without trees, we cannot make paper. The cloud is essential for the paper to exist. If the cloud is not here, the sheet of paper cannot be here either. So we can say that the cloud and the paper inter are. Interbeing is a word that is not in the dictionary yet, but if we combine the prefix inter with a verb be, we have the new verb interbe. He goes on, if we look into the sheet of paper even more deeply, we can see the sunshine in it. If the sunshine is not there, the forest cannot grow. In fact, nothing can grow. Even we cannot grow without sunshine. And so we know that the sunshine is also in the sheet of paper. The paper and the sunshine interare. And if we continue to look, we can see the logger who cut the tree and brought it to the mill to be transformed into paper. And we can see the wheat. We know that the logger cannot exist without his daily bread, and therefore the wheat that became his bread is also in the sheet of paper. And the logger's father and mother are in it too. When we look in this way, we see that without all of these things, the sheet of paper cannot exist. Look even more deeply. We can see that we are in it too. This is not difficult to see, because when you look at the sheet of paper is part of our perception. Your mind is in here, and mine is also. So we can say that everything is here in the sheet of paper. You cannot point out one thing that is not here. Time, space, the earth, the rain, the minerals in the soil, the sunshine, the cloud, the river. Everything coexists with this sheet of paper. That is why I think the word interbe should be in the dictionary. To be is to interbe. You cannot just be by yourself alone. You have to interbe with every other thing. The sheet of paper is because everything else is. If we apply the same logic to our relationship with others, we can see how necessary others are to our very existence. We can find others in ourselves and we in them. And seeing deeply like this gives us a compelling reason to treat them with the love, kindness, compassion, and patience we want for ourselves, no matter how they treat us. And furthermore, the way we react and conduct ourselves now is creating the causes for our coming experiences. The lines of connection from our past to our present keep on unraveling as we move into the future, in the same way as a fishing line unravels when a fisherman casts a line and baited hook from the beach far out over the waves. But the way we react and conduct ourselves is very much dependent not only on our past experiences, but also on the circumstances and people we meet up with. When someone bumps into us in Queen Street, if they are well-dressed and apologize politely, we might smile, say it's okay, and move on. However, if they're scruffy and smelly and growl rudely at us, we may have a very different reaction. What I'm trying to point out here is how our conviction of being isolates is really contrary to what is really going on, even in a walk down Queen Street. So many mutually dependent circumstances have made that walk possible. It's as if we are merely one knot in a net, inextricably intertwined with uncountable others. And it's for this reason that those others are not just isolated bits of consciousness moving past our isolated bit of consciousness, but part of the causes and conditions for our present and future experiences. Together, we are creating our collective reality and our individual futures. So others are extremely important to us, even if they appear as complete strangers. We Buddhists say we want to attain enlightenment, but what does that mean? Well, we all have some idea that it means the end of all suffering forever. Of course, we debate on what that means, whether it's a continual and internal state of awakened bliss or an ultimate passing out. But whichever, we can only achieve it by realizing and acting within our dependence on all others. It will be impossible to achieve enlightenment if we don't take notice of all who provide us with a means to attain enlightenment, who create the very conditions for that attainment. Like trying to travel from Auckland to Wellington in a motor car without taking any notice of roads. This is the point that we've come to in our discussion of Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. In Chapter 6, the chapter on patience, as some of the last verses we considered in our last program stated, therefore, the Mighty One has said that the field of sentient beings is similar to a Buddha field, for many who have pleased them have thereby reached perfection. A Buddha's qualities are gained from the sentient beings and the conquerors alike. So why do I not respect them in the same way as I respect the conquerors? And so we come to this perhaps surprising conclusion that if we are really intent on freeing ourselves of samsara, we must revere other sentient beings as much as we revere those who have completed the path and taught us how to do it, the Buddhas. As Shantideva points out, and as Thich Nhat Hanh corroborates, others are as important as the Buddhas in our spiritual work. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in his commentary on this work, says that we can actually accumulate more merit through our interactions with sentient beings than with the Buddha. We can make offerings, generate devotion, and so on for the Buddha. But if we want a happy rebirth in a life to come, we have to practice ethics. And to do that, we must have other sentient beings as a basis. We cannot kill, steal, indulge in sexual misconduct, and so on without other beings. If I want to eat sheep meat, I must have a sheep to get the meat from. And similarly, if I want to develop patience or love, I must have other beings to practice on, even if it's a sheep. It's a little difficult to practice patience for a rock, for instance, even though the rock is indispensable to my history. His Holiness says, when we obtain a favorable form of existence, such as a human body, even many qualities of the human body that we would consider desirable, such as a pleasant appearance, having material wealth and so on, are also the consequences of virtuous deeds. For example, a pleasant appearance is the consequence of patience and tolerance, and material wealth is a consequence of the practice of generosity. Even these practices become possible only when there are other sentient beings. They cannot occur in a vacuum. This is the case with the limited purpose of obtaining a favorable rebirth, His Holiness says. It is even more true in terms of the path for obtaining full liberation from samsara, in which we need to practice many other things. For instance, in order to attain full enlightenment, we need to practice love, compassion, and many other aspects of the path. Of these, we find that unless there's an interaction with other sentient beings, there is no possibility of even beginning. So, if we compare Buddhas and sentient beings in terms of their contribution to acquiring stores of merit, sentient beings, in fact, seem to have a greater contribution than the Buddhas. That's what His Holiness says. And of course, if we compare sentient beings and Buddhas, there's no comparison with regards to qualities. The Buddhas have perfected all their qualities, but sentient beings are full of all sorts of delusions and weaknesses. Yet that makes them even more precious. So filled with faults, they nevertheless make a vital contribution to our progress on the spiritual path, so their value cannot be underestimated. The great beings have already perfected themselves, so they have nothing else to do but help sentient beings. As His Holiness says, it is their duty. But that is not so with sentient beings. So what they give us on the spiritual journey is even more valuable than what the Buddhas contribute. Like Thich Nhat Hanh, His Holiness also points out that we depend on others not only to attain enlightenment, but also for the happiness we encounter in our daily life. Generally, we ascribe happiness in life to three things: good health, good material facilities, and good companions. The causes for good health are not harming others, but taking care of them, keeping them out of danger. In this way, we create the positive potential to experience good health in the future. As His Holiness explains, here again, in order to enjoy good health, other sentient beings have a great role, because one needs to acquire the merit necessary to obtain that. Then, if we closely examine the material facilities that we use for our enjoyment of life, we find that there are hardly any material objects which have no sources in other people. All these facilities, if one thinks carefully, come into being as a result of the efforts of many people, either directly or indirectly. Many people are involved in making them possible. Similarly, in order to enjoy a happy life, we need good companions, a circle of friends. When we talk about friends and companions, we speak of interaction with other human beings. While the relationships might involve hardships, like a lot of quarrels and cursing, in spite of all this, we have to try to maintain friendships and lead a way of life in which there's enough interaction with others in order to be happy. So here we see that even these three factors, good health, material possessions, and friendship, are all inextricably linked with other people's efforts and cooperation. So, however we look at it, from the standpoint of enlightenment or our conventional life, others are vital to our happiness. This is why, when we develop a motivation for our actions, we have to remember other sentient beings and not only create actions motivated for our own happiness. It doesn't matter what tradition in Buddhism we're from. Loving kindness and compassion are stressed as vitally important. It is only through the development of these that we can attain the perfected state, and we can only generate kindness and compassion if other sentient beings exist. If they did not, we would not be able to gain enlightenment. So we motivate our actions not only for our own happiness, but for the happiness and freedom from suffering of all beings. And that is why we are involved in this program today. Let's take a moment then to really make sure our motivation is in line with that, so we will attain enlightenment like the Buddha did, to be of the greatest benefit to every being we come across. Thank you. Now, the next verse in the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life is still talking about the comparison between sentient beings and Buddhas, and it says, "Of course, they're not similar in the quality of their intentions, but only in the fruits that they produce. So it is in this respect that they have excellent qualities and are therefore said to be equal." Now, when we look at the aims of the Buddhas and those of sentient beings, they're quite different. For most of us sentient beings, although we might say we want to achieve Buddhahood, our aims are mixed up with the concerns for this life: enough money, food, shelter and companions, and so on. And often, against our intentions, those concerns take precedence over our practices for enlightenment. It's no wonder we take so long to get to Buddhahood. But the Buddha's aims are quite different. They have no concerns for themselves and are totally focused on helping others. So it doesn't matter if they don't get food or shelter, so long as their actions are benefiting others. Once the great master Lama Zopa Rinpoche was on a long plane journey, and when a meal was served, it took so long to make offerings of it to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that he was still going when the stewardess came to take the dishes away. He hadn't eaten anything, but Lama Zopa Rinpoche said it was okay. The food had served its real purpose. It is also said of the same master that he is so intent on practice for others that he never sleeps. I've even heard a story, though I don't know how true it is, that he's taken a vow never to sleep again until all sentient beings are enlightened. Whether that story is true or not, it's the attitude of a great being. We can see how different that is from the attitude of someone like myself, who, if I don't get even a couple of hours sleep a night, gets all grumpy with everyone the next day. But Shantideva says we shouldn't compare Buddhas and sentient beings according to their aims. We have to look at the results they're capable of producing. If we look at that, we can see that their results are the same. Both are the causes for enlightenment. The Buddhas by teaching us how to get there, and sentient beings by being the conditions by which we can practice what the Buddha teaches us. But also in the next verse, Shantideva says, "Whatever merit comes from venerating one with a loving mind is due to the eminence of sentient beings. And in the same way, the merit of having faith in Buddha is due to the eminence of Buddha." Someone who has perfected love, the wish for others to be happy, is a very powerful object for veneration if we want to generate positive potential. Remember the story of St. Francis of Assisi, who had a special connection with animals. Once a deer, who was being chased by a hunter, ran to St. Francis for protection. When the hunter arrived on the scene, he claimed the deer was his, and drawing his bow, shot an arrow at it. However, St. Francis put out his hand, and the arrow pierced that instead. The hunter was so astounded someone would do that, he calmed down and eventually asked St. Francis to teach him, with the result that he stopped being a hunter and became a devotee of the saint instead. Making offerings to a person with the amount of love St. Francis is reputed to have had, he is said to have even called the sun and moon his brother and sister, is said to create enormous positive potential. That positive potential is generated in reliance on the person, who is not necessarily a Buddha. So that, Shantideva says, shows how very important sentient beings are. But we also generate great positive potential by having faith in and revering a Buddha. So that shows how important Buddhas are in our request for enlightenment. And so, Shantideva goes on, "Therefore they are asserted to be equal in the share they have in establishing Buddha qualities. but none of them are equal in good qualities with the Buddhas, who are boundless oceans of excellence. It is obvious that when we compare the qualities of the Buddhas and sentient beings, those of the Buddha far outshine those of sentient beings. For instance, Buddhas have the clairvoyance to see far into the past, and so know exactly where sentient beings are really coming from and how to help them, while we only see what appears in front of our noses most of the time, and so can make only very limited judgments and decisions, which often enough work out quite differently from what we intended. So in respect of qualities, Buddhas and sentient beings are not at all equal. But when we realize that they are both necessary to gaining enlightenment, we can say that they are equal. Even if the three realms were offered, it would be insufficient in paying veneration to those few beings in whom a mere share of the good qualities of the unique assembly of excellence appears. Thus, since sentient beings have a share in giving rise to the Supreme Buddha qualities, surely it is correct to venerate them, as they are similar in merely this respect. If we were to find someone with even the minutest bit of the good qualities of the Buddhas in their hearts, it would be so valuable that even if we were to make offerings equal to all the wonderful things we could find in the formless form and desire realms, it would not be enough, as Shantideva says. It would be a very little gesture. The qualities of the Buddhas are so great, they're like a diamond. Even a small chip of diamond outshines all other gemstones. So it is impossible to venerate one with even a little of those qualities too much. Yet, says Shantideva, sentient beings have that within them that gives rise to Buddhahood. And so at least from the point of view of their kindness to us, sentient beings are truly worthy of our homage and respect. Pema Chodron writes, "Certainly the enlightened ones have a great deal more merit and wakefulness available to them than you and I. But even the littlest bit of merit or wakefulness makes us worthy of unlimited offerings. The slightest recognition of bodhicitta, the slightest willingness to enter the bodhisattva path, makes us worthy of offering as the Buddhas." I find these very encouraging words. And then Shantideva goes on, "Furthermore, what way is there to repay the Buddhas who grant immeasurable benefit and who befriend the world without pretension other than by pleasing sentient beings? The Buddha's sole interest is to help others. Unlike us, they have realized no inherent self exists, and so are beyond the petty emotional dramas and karma we create based on our clinging to such an egoistic idea. Free from such bonds, Buddhas are able to concentrate all their efforts on helping sentient beings. So, as their great love and compassion extend equally to all beings, if we harm other sentient beings, we certainly don't make the Buddhas happy. Whereas, if we work for the benefit of others and bring them happiness, we will also bring the Buddhas joy. And as the Buddhas are constantly working for our benefit, how else can we repay their kindness except, says Shantideva, by working for those beings the Buddhas care for so much?" And then in the next verse, the text goes on to talk about how to develop patience in the face of harm from others. "Therefore, since benefiting these beings will repay those who give their bodies and enter the deepest hell for their sake, I shall behave impeccably in all that I do, even if they cause me a great deal of harm. If they were able to help us by going to the hell realms, the Buddhas would not hesitate to do so. They have actualized the verse from the practice manual called the Guru Puja that says, 'Even if we must remain for an ocean of eons in the fiery hells of Avicii for the sake of one sentient being alone, we seek your blessings to complete the perfection of joyous effort, to strive with compassion for supreme enlightenment and not be discouraged.' There is nothing the Buddhas would not do to help us gain the happiness of perfect enlightenment. So really, they are exceptionally kind to us. It is difficult to repay such kindness. It is not as though the great beings need anything we can give them. However, what we can do to repay their kindness is to do as they wish, which is to be kind and loving to others, even if those others are only intent on harming us. This is, after all, just following the Buddha's example and teaching. As we've said before, the Buddha does not generate even the least harmful thought towards others, even if they wish to kill him. In many lives, Devadatta tried to harm the Buddha, even setting traps to kill him. But the Buddha never had any anger or harmful thought against Devadatta. And even later, he rescued Devadatta from the hellish result of all his negative karma against the Buddha. In this verse, Shantideva then says, if we want to pay back the kindness the Buddhas have shown us, we can do it by following their examples and not generating even the slightest harmful intention towards others, though they may regard themselves as our worst enemy and only wish to harm us. Which is easy to say, but extremely difficult to do, as you will realize. It is so easy when a perceived harm arises against us to, even without thinking, want to take revenge or wish something nasty will happen to the person creating the harm. We don't even have to consider it. The intention just arises. That makes it even more important that we meditate as much as we can on love and compassion to weaken this harmful intention so we can eventually be free of it. Pema Chodron says that even if we just think on an everyday level, we can see that others do so much to save us from suffering. Even if we don't have a Dharma teacher, she says, we know what it is to be benefited by family, friends, or even strangers. There are people willing to go through personal inconvenience and pain to help us. And Shantideva is saying that now we can repay them by treating each other with loving kindness. And Geshe Jampa Tekchok, a great master in the Tibetan tradition, referring to Shantideva's text, has this to say about the kindness of others. Shantideva pointed out that everything good, every form of happiness, all positive qualities and so forth, comes through the kindness of others. Therefore, the mind devoted to their welfare is like a wish-fulfilling jewel, the source of all happiness and everything good and useful in the world. Just as a farmer who possesses an extremely fertile field where everything he plants always grows is very happy to have it and cherishes and takes great care of it, we should feel the same way about other sentient beings, that they are extremely valuable and cherish and take care of them. It is interesting that, whether we are a Buddhist or not, if we think about the great kindness of all beings, that all our happiness does indeed depend upon them. Therefore, it is so important to contemplate every day how harmful the mind of that slots people into friend, enemy, and stranger is. As long as we can't see that everyone is our benefactor, we will continue to cling to those who appear beneficial to us and push away those we see as harmful. This just strengthens our mistaken concept that beings are independent isolates, and we lapse further into the fog of ignorance that forgets interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh calls it. As he says, you cannot just be by yourself alone. You have to interbe with every other thing, and that especially means every other sentient being. And now we've come to the end of the program, and I wish you all a very happy coming week. Please take a moment, as we usually do, to dedicate the positive potential of this program to gaining enlightenment to best benefit all other sentient beings. Thank you. Please join us again next week. Till then, goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering.